From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen says she'll stay on that job through Wednesday to ensure an orderly transition. Her abrupt resignation, maybe firing, came yesterday after a meeting with President Trump. Today, she spoke with reporters but didn't take questions as she was leaving her home. She said she's committed to a smooth transition at DHS.
I share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border. And other than that, I'm on my way to keep doing what I can for the next few days. So thank you all for being here.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is with us now. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
Well, and Nielsen, we have to remind ourselves, led DHS after John Kelly left to become the White House chief of staff. In her written statement yesterday, she kind of blamed Congress for not passing laws to help her with immigration policy. But do we know what happened in that meeting yesterday? These two have clashed, Nielsen and the president. What happened?
Right. And you just heard her say that she agrees with the president's goal to deal with the crisis, but she didn't say she agreed with the president's means. And that's what the clashes were about. We understand that the president repeatedly asked her to do things that she felt were unconstitutional or wouldn't pass legal muster. And she explained that to him, and he got very frustrated. He blamed her for the spike in illegal border crossings and asylum applications at the border. And he was mad that she couldn't do anything about it. Mm. But she has been on the short list for people who we thought were about to be let go for quite some time. So maybe the question is, how did she last as long as she did?
Yeah. Well, what have lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, said about it?
Well, Democrats, of course, were very unhappy with Trump's immigration policy. They saw her as the public face of that policy. They felt that she misled them when she was asked if the administration had a child separation policy. She said it didn't. Turns out it did. And as a matter of fact, there's now reports that the president wants to bring that back. Yeah. He felt that separating kids at the border from their parents was an effective way of deterring them from making the trip. And that is something that has always been controversial.
Yeah.
But most members of Congress understand that Nielsen was not making immigration policy. She was merely trying to carry out Donald Trump's wishes. Immigration is a very, very important issue for him. It's important to his base. It was one of his central issues in 2016 and will be again in 2020.
Well, the president has said that Kevin McLeanin, the commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, will take over. He'll be sort of the acting head. He's a holdover from the Obama administration. You are saying that the president wants to be even tougher, more hard-nosed in some of his policies at the border. What's the sense
well,
there?
Well, that's what he said. He said we're going in a tougher direction. I don't know if that means revisiting or reviving the family separation policy. But Kevin McAleenan is unlikely to be the permanent DHS secretary. Names have been floated like Chris Kobach from Kansas or Rick Perry, who's now the energy secretary. But interestingly enough, Kevin McAleenan, not only is he a holdover from the Obama administration, but he is not known as an immigration hardliner. As a matter of fact, he has talked about asylum seekers as vulnerable families. He's talked about working with governments in Central America to improve economic opportunities there, so there's not as much motivation for people from Honduras or El Salvador or Guatemala to come to try to get into the U.S. So he's unlikely to be permanent, but he is definitely not known to be a real hardliner on immigration.
So that can't last long. But as you say, he's going to be acting, which has given, you know, cable anchors, you know, the chance to have a lot of fun with that word, acting heads of departments, which the president has a lot of. They've got a record turnover in this administration.
Well, right now they only have three major acting cabinet secretaries, Department of Defense, Homeland Security, of course, and Interior. Back in January, half of the cabinet was acting.
Yeah.
But the president has said he likes this. He likes people to be acting. It gives him more flexibility. Of course, he gets to have these people on a very short leash, but this is what he prefers. So he's got a lot of acting cabinet secretaries.
Right. And just in the 45 seconds we have here, Mara, Who's whispering in the president's ear? We spoke elsewhere in the program about the influence of Stephen Miller, and we've had the president saying, I'm closing the border. No, I'm not. Firing the head of a department. Who's behind
I think Stephen
this?
Miller has always been the most important voice in the White House on immigration. He's a hardliner. He certainly had these views on immigration long before he came to the Trump White House. He believes in getting rid of the Dreamer program, birthright mm-hmm. citizenship. He's one of the people who came up with the idea of an immigration czar. This is not really a battle for Trump's mind. It's mm-hmm. just that Stephen Miller is the most prominent voice on this, and I think he'll continue to be.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, violence has flared up again in Libya. Forces loyal to a military commander are trading fire with militias aligned with the UN-backed government. The fighting is in and around the capital of Tripoli. The U.S. has evacuated a small contingent of counterterrorism troops out of the country yesterday. This is the latest unrest in a country that has never really settled down after the 2011 uprising that ousted Libya's longtime dictator, Muammar Gaddafi. Rana Jawad is the BBC's North Africa correspondent. And Rana, what sparked this latest round of violence?
Well, it was an attack that was initially launched by General Khalifa Haftar, who is the commander of forces that are based in eastern Libya. If you recall, there are two centers of power in Libya, one that is based in the east of the country, which is where the parliament, the elected parliament, sits, and another center of power, which is based in Tripoli in western Libya, which is where the internationally recognized government sits. But the parliament in the east doesn't recognize the government that sits in the west. And so this force that attacked Tripoli technically is under the parliament in the east. The general that commands it has long had ambitions, according to many, and he's certainly not made a secret of having a greater political role in the country and a very senior military role. So this latest attack on the capital is seen as part of his wider military campaign in the country, which included controlling much of eastern Libya, as well as parts of southern Libya more recently.
Well, and tell us more about Khalifa Haftar. I understand he's a U.S. citizen.
Well, yes, he spent decades in the U.S. when he was exiled from Libya by the late and overthrown leader, Colonel Gaddafi. And he spent many, many years in the U.S. before returning to Libya in 2011 to take part in the revolution that overthrew Colonel Gaddafi from power.
And as he launches this offensive against Tripoli, what are you hearing from people in the area? What's the humanitarian situation like?
Well, it's pretty dire. The UN says some 2,800 people have so far been displaced in 5 days of fighting. There are a lot of people trapped, and those who need assistance can't get any because of the intense fighting. What the UN has been calling for since yesterday is a 2-hour humanitarian ceasefire so that people can be evacuated, as well as any casualties who may be there. So far, that call has not been heeded by any of the factions currently taking part in these battles, which of course includes Haftar's forces, as well as various militia groups who nominally work for the government in Tripoli.
And if Haftar does make it all the way to Tripoli and the city falls, what does that mean for this conflict that has been simmering now for many years?
It's a difficult question for anyone to answer at this stage. I mean, you even talk to diplomats, and I've been speaking to several over the last few days, and they're all scratching their heads over what to do next. I know from diplomatic sources that American officials have been putting a lot of pressure on Haftar the last few days to de-escalate the situation. If Haftar takes over, it's highly unlikely for him to be able to control the capital unless the bigger militias that are based there and are from there switch sides, essentially.
We mentioned the U.S. taking some of its troops from the city as a result of all of this. It's not very many. But back in 2016, then-President Obama called his handling of the aftermath of the revolution in Libya the worst mistake of his presidency. Just remind us what the role of the United States has been in the country.
I think it wasn't just the U.S. It was a collective miscalculation, as they would put it now, with hindsight, over what the country needed moving forward and what it meant to take out a dictator who had run the country through and through for 42 years. The U.S.'s operations and interests in Libya over the last couple of years or so have largely been limited to carrying out airstrikes against known hideouts of members of the so-called Islamic State. At one point, there was a large presence of them up until 2016, when a big battle was fought to expel them from a city they'd taken. And over the last 2 years, what we've seen is the U.S. occasionally carrying out airstrikes in that regard.
That's the BBC's Rana Jawad speaking with us about this recent flare-up of violence in and around Tripoli. Rana, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Question, what if we've got it all wrong and counting calories is not the way to lose weight? Well, according to economist writer Peter Wilson, it's not, and it's time to bury the world's most misleading measure. His article in The Economist's new 1843 magazine is called Death of the Calorie. He also writes about the birth. Did you know the word calorie comes from the Latin calor for heat and was originally used to measure the efficiency of steam engines? That in the late 1800s, the thinking was that food-deprived people needed more fuel, so high-caloric food was encouraged. Or that in 2016, a researcher discovered that back in 1967, sugar companies secretly funded Harvard studies blaming fat for obesity. So out went fat, and in came sugar and salt-infused low-calorie diet foods, and up went obesity rates. Writer Peter Wilson joins us from London. Peter, who knew?
Hi. Well, I certainly didn't know until I spent a lot of time researching this story. It was a big shock for me, too.
It's just wonderful. You have Italian physicians in the 1800s hanging themselves in weighing chairs so they could weigh themselves, then everything that came into them and everything that came out of them. We'll talk more about this, but we want to right up front say you are not concluding that what one eats is not related to weight gain or that overeating doesn't cause weight gain.
No, the problem is we are obsessed with the calorie. And health officials in America and elsewhere tell people that basically obesity is caused by a calorie imbalance. Count your calories, the calories in and the calories out in exercise, and you'll lose weight. You'll be okay. And it's just not true.
Right. Well, talk about some of the reasons why. I mean, start with the alarming misrepresentation of calories on packaging. You say processed frozen foods can miss the true caloric content by 70%.
The amazing thing is that these labels, either on a restaurant menu or on the side of a packet, are virtually never regulated. There are six different ways in America that a food manufacturer is permitted to calculate the calories in their product. And when researchers do tests, they find that in 7% of cases is the number on the packet within 10 calories of the real number. And in a fifth of cases, it's 100 calories out. That we're not making informed decisions.
Well, but you also rushed to point out a calorie is a real thing. I mean, you take us through the fascinating history of the study of it. Food was burned in labs to calculate the energy that's released. By the way, is that still how calories are determined? I mean, literally burned to see energy released?
Yes, that's the most accurate way. I spent some time while researching this story at King's College watching some food products that I bought here in London being burned in one of these, it's called a bomb calorimeter. And of course, the calorie readings on the packet were nowhere near accurate.
But even when a calorie is right, talk about some of the other reasons that we can't be too sort of addicted to calorie counting.
That is the thing that really stunned me, that not only are the numbers wrong, and not only are the databases wrong, but the whole idea that your weight loss is all about calories in minus calories out is just nonsense. The body is nothing like one of these little devices that I saw being used in a laboratory, that when food goes into a body, it's incredibly complex what happens. You know, the difference between sugar, the interaction of our genes, of our hormones like insulin, the bugs in our stomach.
Well, and for instance, the early researchers didn't care. You know, they just saw leafy greens, for instance, as something that didn't have a high caloric count, which people might have needed who didn't have a lot of food. So they'd recommend something, you know, fatty over spinach, for instance, back then, because they weren't thinking that way. And you mentioned genes. Just recently, a certain gene was found to be more often in fat people than skinny ones. You remind us some people have intestines that are 50% longer than others, and the shorter ones absorb fewer calories. It takes people from 8 to 80 hours for food to move through them. We're all different. And so, you know, calories are absorbed while they're sitting there waiting for 80 hours to, you know, come out the other end. And you know, sleep, for instance, is a factor.
Exactly. And if you haven't rested enough, you are likely to take on more calories from the exact same food that somebody else would eat. And with a good night's sleep, they won't create the same fat. Weight management, what we're talking about is fat creation. How well you chew your food has an impact. The time of day that you eat has an impact. There are just so many factors in our behavior that it just becomes silly to count calories and say, oh, well, because I've only eaten 2,500 calories today, that is fine. Or to say, this chocolate muffin only has 200 calories, so it's going to be better for my weight control than this healthy sandwich because it's an extra 10 calories.
Can we talk about why that is? Because you, for instance, give the description of a soda, which sends a shot of energy, 30 calories a minute, takes it in quickly. And let's say potatoes or rice might take 2 calories a minute, you know, to process. But all calories trigger insulin, which help break down the food that we've eaten. So tell us why it matters if you eat something that's high in sugar or that's, you know, maybe takes longer to process.
The whole calorie system is based on the simple mathematical approach that energy in minus energy out. And that any calorie that goes into the body is the same as any other calorie. And that is just nonsense because all those different types of food have different effects within the body. The amount of sugar that is in a food will affect the insulin response. And this is, you know, probably one of the reasons that diabetes is exploding around the world because we ignore the sugar content. To have 100 calories of sugar versus 100 calories of protein is very different. Even 100 calories of fat is very different. So the insulin that a big hit of sugar triggers within the body to rush into the blood supply and try and get that glucose, that blood sugar, out of the blood has a huge impact. It starts stacking that sugar into fat cells. Once the blood sugar level drops, you're left hungry. So you've not only got fatter, you've got hungrier, and you're more likely to go out and, you know, have another chocolate bar.
Make sure I've heard you right. A sudden hit of sugar, let's say that soda or that muffin, prompts a rapid release of insulin, which carries the sugar out of the bloodstream into the body's cells. But when there's too much sugar and it can't get it out fast enough, maybe it'll store some in the liver, but it will most likely stash it as fat. So you get this quick reaction. But then on the other side, you get fat and you get a drop in energy because it's been so quick and it's gone.
Yes, and it leaves you hungry. So less fat, body fat, is created the more slowly the nutrients are absorbed by the body. So one of the first things I did while I was researching this story, I changed my own behavior and I just lost a stack of weight. I've lost 28 pounds while working on this story.
Wow. Well, because you found other things as well that were fascinating. The way you cook food makes a difference, and also when you eat it. So, for instance, pasta cooked one day but eaten leftover the next day is half the caloric intake?
That's right. And the staggering thing, Robin, is we're only just learning a lot of this now. It's only in the last couple of years that researchers have discovered if you take pasta or toast and let it cool and then reheat it and eat it, you will take on fewer calories.
What?
Because, well, the molecular structure of the compounds changes and it forms different sort of crystal type shapes and it will then pass through your body more. Your body will take in fewer of those calories. We don't do nearly enough research on food, which is just amazing. You know, when you think how important it is to our quality of life, to public finances, you think about the health system, the amount of money that's spent on food-related problems, and nobody is really out there doing this basic research.
Some of your other findings, exercise, of course, has tremendous health benefits, but unless you're really high level, it plays a smaller part in weight control than most people think. As much as 75% of the average person's daily energy expenditure doesn't come from exercise, but just moving around. And with that in mind, drinking ice water forces the body to burn calories to maintain its preferred temperature.
Drinking ice water is the only thing you can do that actually means negative calories.
Yeah.
Because there are no calories in water, but by putting that cold product into your body will burn energy to return to its preferred temperature.
It sounds like, Peter Wilson, that you have become, like one of the people you profile, a calorie dissident. We know that Weight Watchers shifted its own whole program away from calories to a point system with this in mind. But isn't there still some value to people knowing what the calories are in things on their menu, even if they're off a bit, just to be reminded of what they're eating?
You're right. I mean, it's not that we should totally ignore calories, but the problem is what we do with calories. We pretend and we tell people that it's all about calories. It's just one of many factors. And by overstating it, we lead people to make the wrong choice. We miss the point, and we make people feel guilty and ashamed, when what we should be teaching people is to focus on the quality of what they eat. Don't eat as much processed food, eat natural food. It's just a totally different way of thinking about food. Eat the way we're supposed to eat originally.
That's Peter Wilson. His article in The Economist's new 1843 magazine is Death of a Calorie. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, a revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
How did California tourist Kim Endicott win release from her captors in Uganda? Various reports say her tour company paid part or all of a ransom, but last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said while that's understandable, it leads to more kidnappings. But should you get kidnapping insurance? Lawyer Joshua Gold specializes in insurance disputes. And Joshua, workers in danger zones often get insured through employers, but you write, you may not even know you have it. It's complicated.
It is complicated. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of public information in this realm. The insurance policies themselves in this arena often impose a condition of confidentiality. So oftentimes a corporation will buy a kidnap and ransom policy, and most of the employees and executives will not even know it exists.
Well, in fact, that's a requirement in some policies. Why is that? Because is the fear that the employee might fake a kidnapping? Or why can't they know?
I think often it's not so much a concern about a fake kidnapping. It's the concern that probably you just alluded to with the official government statements, that if it is known that there is money standing behind a tourist or a visitor in a foreign country, it puts a bullseye on that person because would-be kidnappers know that they can indeed get a king's ransom if they commit that crime.
And we understand the coverage can be for death and dismemberment, terrible thought, business interruption costs, things like that, but also ransom or extortion payments. But apparently there's some things you should know before buying one of these policies because of the restrictions. For instance, there are companies that require that you notify them as soon as the kidnapping happens. And of course, that might endanger the person who's been kidnapped. And so you say go for a policy that requires that you notify the insurance company and law enforcement only when it's safe and practicable to do so.
Yeah, no, that's just right. And oftentimes, if you're a smart shopper and you have a good insurance broker by your side, you can usually get that preferred policy language in there that avoids those kinds of fine print traps.
Can the average traveler get kidnap coverage? I would think it would be pretty prohibitive, expensive.
I am sure it's expensive, especially depending upon what part of the world you're going to. And I think you can often find an insurance solution if you are willing to pay the price. Like everything, you bring up a good point, which is it so expensive that you may be better off canceling your travel plans?
If it's that dangerous. Well, and you also remind us that the government does post warnings and advisories for places where citizens may be at risk of being kidnapped, you know, places that are very dangerous. And many policies often exclude coverage if a warning has been issued about a region. So that's another piece of small print to look at.
It absolutely is. So always make sure that the insurance coverage matches up with your risk exposure. So needless to say, if your insurance policy says no coverage for going to certain parts of Latin America, and that's exactly where your employees or executives may be traveling, you need to keep shopping and look for a more suitable protective policy.
Joshua Gold, a lawyer who specializes in insurance coverage disputes. Joshua, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, everyone.
A researcher has discovered the identity of the last known survivor of the transatlantic slave trade in the United States. She was a 12-year-old girl named Radoshi, kidnapped in 1860 from West Africa and given the name of Sally Smith when she arrived in Alabama. She made the journey on the Clotilda, the last known slave ship to arrive in this country. Hannah Durkin is the researcher at Newcastle University. And Professor, what can you tell us about Radoshi's early life in West Africa?
Yeah, well, very little, unfortunately, because basically the sources, the archival material, gives very little detail about her life in West Africa. Well, there's one newspaper interview with her in 1932 that suggests, that uses all these sort of fantasies of Africa that doesn't really help us to understand her life. Hmm. But it appears that she was from the same town as Cudjoe Lewis, who is previously thought to be the last Middle Passage survivor, and I guess a really good resource for understanding Cudjoe Lewis's life and therefore Radoshi's life is a book by Sylviane Diouf called Dreams of Africa in Alabama. So that's really helpful, I think, for telling the Clotilda survivor's story.
What else can you tell us about the Clotilda? It has a rich history, and I understand it's at the bottom of the Mobile Bay.
Yes, archaeologists are actually currently searching for it. They thought they'd found it early last year, but it turned out that the boat was too big. I mean, for a long time, its existence was denied. So the story, the horrible life experiences of the Clotilda survivors was also denied. And many of the Clotilda survivors set up a community called Africa Town in Alabama, you know, which was incredible because as soon as they achieved their freedom, they tried to return home, but obviously they weren't able to do that. And so they actually set up a community among themselves. Descendants still live in Africa Town.
Can you tell us what happened to this young girl as she went from being known as Radoshi in Africa to Sally Smith in Alabama? What was her life like?
Yeah, well, I mean, she basically was purchased by a man called Washington Smith as soon as she arrived in the US. So she was sold immediately, apparently as a child bride. She was forced to work in both the fields and in the house, you know, the slave owner's house. She was basically enslaved for about 5 years. And she was still had to work as a sharecropper. Her husband had to work as a sharecropper on, you know, on the land in which they were enslaved. But it does eventually appear that they managed to buy their own land because the community that they lived in, it's called Bogue Chitto, but I think it's pronounced locally as Boga Chitta. That was a community of landowners. So somehow they managed to buy their own land.
Her story is so different because she was the last survivor of this U.S. slave ship. And it was just 5 years before the end of the Civil War. She was not born into slavery, nor was she a slave for as long as so many people were. How did she adapt to life as a free woman?
Yes, that's right. I mean, she was certainly, she was only enslaved for a short period of time, but obviously she was, you know, economically exploited and, you know, forced to sort of, to live a very sort of limited life, a very impoverished life. What's incredible, I think, about Radoshi is that she worked so hard to retain her language and to pass it on to her daughter and some of her grandchildren. She worked to hold on to her West African religious belief. So she was, you know, just incredible resilience in what must have been, you know, an unimaginably traumatic experience, together with obviously the permanent separation from your homeland. It's just sort of very hard to, you know, to comprehend what she must have been through.
There's even video footage of her from the 1930s. We're going to listen to some of it now. This was made by the Department of Agriculture, and it's titled The Negro Farmer, Extension Work for Better Farming and Better Living. Let's listen.
Aunt Sally Smith, born in Africa and long past her 110th year when she died in 1937, lived to see the hard lot endured by her generation and that of her children in some measure bettered by this campaign to help Negroes help themselves.
It's just amazing to hear that narrator just describe her life. First of all, we do not believe, or was she really 110 years old when she died?
Well, certainly the census data is contradictory, but unfortunately, you know, there seems to have been a denial, perhaps, in the census data of how recently she came, or by the census takers, of how recently she arrived in the U.S. So it's very difficult to tell exactly how old she was, but certainly the civil rights leader who met her in the 1930s and seems to have been really inspired by her, Amelia Boynton Robinson, who of course went on to play a leading role in the, you know, fight for voting rights.
Right.
Well, finally achieved in the 1960s. She claimed that she was a 12-year-old bride. So given that she also claimed, or Amelia Boynton Robinson also claimed that she was married to a man of a different ethnicity, given that the sort of the census data does support that she was married to a man who was also African-born and we can assume also came over on the Clotilda, it does sort of add, you know, sort of gives weight to, I think, Amelia Boynton Robinson's claim.
Mm.
Certainly in the film footage that you just played, there's a sense of presenting her as a sort of living relic of, you know, of history of slavery. And it's sort of presenting her in a way that is, you know, sort of not really telling a story at all and not really giving her a voice. In fact, you can see her mouth move in the film footage, but there's no audio track, so you can't hear directly from her.
And yet, when you see that footage, it just reminds you how shockingly modern this history actually is.
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that she died in 1937, and I guess we can never really tell if she was the last Middle Passage survivor, but certainly as far as we can perhaps document, she was certainly, you know, the U.S. slave trade anyway.
You'd mentioned some of the activists who had known about this woman. The author, Zora Neale Hurston, had also written about her. I just wonder how you were able to make the connection that she was, as far as we know, the last known survivor of the U.S. transatlantic slave trade. Like, because it wasn't as if she was completely unknown.
No, I mean, certainly. So Zora Neale Hurston wrote a letter to Langston Hughes in which she referred to Radoshi, but she didn't name her. And so I was looking at this posthumously published manuscript called Every Tongue Got to Confess.
Mm.
And it happened to have an index in it with all of the names of her interviewees. And there happened to be one woman called Sally Smith, born in Africa. And I sort of realized that was the woman in the letter. And so I looked at a book that had just been reissued, actually, by a historian called Alston Fitz. And it just so happened that he'd... I think he must have perhaps he'd read Amelia Boynton Robinson's book, her memoir, and sort of realized that the woman that she was referring to in her memoir as this survivor of, you know, transatlantic slave trade was also the woman that Hurston referred to in the letter. So he'd already made a connection, but I don't think he'd explored it further. So he hadn't worked out that she was a Clotilda survivor, and he hadn't worked out that she outlived Cudjoe Lewis.
Do we know anything about her descendants? Have they weighed in on this discovery?
Well, she had one daughter, but she appears to have had several children, or at least a couple of children, and many grandchildren. Sorry, at least a couple of grandchildren. And quite a few great-grandchildren, I think. And her daughter's married name was Hunter. And I think she had a grandson called Willie Hunter. But certainly potential descendants have been reaching out to me. So I would say to them, if they're listening, it's worth noting that her daughter's married name was Hunter. Given that so few people whose ancestors were enslaved can trace their ancestry back to West Africa, I appreciate how important it is to have, you know, to be able to make those kinds of connections. So I really hope this enables people to make, you know, to trace their ancestry.
And as you've gone through researching this woman, I just wonder what your takeaways are, what this story tells us about this terrible period in American history.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really sad and really, really shocking to sort of be confronted with a woman's life. The thing that really I took away from it, or tried to bring together, was the fact that there are so few, almost no firsthand, you know, personal accounts by women survivors of the transatlantic slave trade. So we have just literally sort of words or a few sentences. So this was about hopefully giving a sense of the lived, you know, realities of this sort of terrible history. That's obviously not just a U.S. history, but it's also British history, it's European history, you know, Caribbean history. This is all of our history. So to give voice to one woman felt, you know, even if it's just one woman, felt really, really important.
And again, not as far back as many of us would like to believe. Hannah Durkin from Newcastle University, who's identified what could be the last known survivor of the transatlantic slave trade, who died in 1937. Professor Durkin, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chinese director and screenwriter Jia Zhangke doesn't make elegant costume dramas about his country's past or create mythical houses of flying daggers, but he's gained an international reputation as the leading filmmaker of a younger generation, and his movies are regularly invited to the Berlin, Cannes, and New York film festivals. His latest is now screening in this country. It's called in English, Ash is Purest White. Howie Mashevitz of member station KUNC reports.
Jia Zhangke is worried about the past disappearing in a relentlessly modernizing China. In one early scene in Ash's Purest White, the past is represented by one man protesting a dying coal mine. The present is a throbbing disco. In the film, the old and the new butt heads, literally and figuratively. Jia shows that struggle through the lives of everyday people.
Since 1998, with my first film, feature film, English title is Pickpocket, until this one, I'm very interested to examine the individual against the backdrop of the drastic transformations of the Chinese society. And I do think that because of that transformation, you have people being left behind and they very much live in the margin of the society. So almost like an outsider looking in to examine and challenge the mainstream culture is very much what I would like to do with all of my films.
What I find most impressive about Jia is the way his films contain both macro and micro.
Dennis Lim is the director of programming at the Film Society of Lincoln Center.
He has a remarkable knack, I think, for grounding these films about modernization, you know, these films about technological and political upheaval. These are what his films are about, but they're also very much about human lives.
In Ash's Purest White, those lives belong to inhabitants of a petty crime underworld, which the filmmaker calls a parallel culture with its own rules and philosophy.
Within the underworld, within Jianghu, the most important two elements were the, or are the interpersonal relationship and the sense of loyalty. But because of the transformation of society, I do think that a lot of people, as a result, they lost themselves in the pursuit of wealth and power and gradually letting go the old values of interpersonal relationship and also the sense of loyalty. So I do think that's the transformation and evolution that we very much want to examine.
It's a world John knows firsthand, says Aliza Ma, head of programming at Metrograph Cinema in New York, who served as Jaw's interpreter in the past.
He talks about a formative experience of having grown up on the streets and working for people who weren't necessarily proper employers, you know, and just being close to marginal characters and noticing these codes of behavior.
With the advent of digital video, Jia Zhongke took to those streets and began filming life as he saw it.
His main concern is showing an unofficial oral history of China that is undocumented by the mainstream media there.
Ma says that approach got Jia into trouble, and his films were not allowed to be shown in theaters. But his reputation spread, and eventually he and his work were invited to the major international film festivals. Lincoln Center's Dennis Lim says that Jia's become a respected contributor to the story of Chinese film.
I think if you look at 21st century cinema internationally, it's hard to not talk about Chinese cinema. And you think of someone like Jia sort of being really at the forefront of that. People look to his films as kind of reflections of what's happening in China today.
And what's happening in China today, says filmmaker Jia Zhongke, is that the past, the country's history and culture, and the people who embody it are being erased.
So speaking of history, I do want to mention the last scene of the film is this female protagonist being captured by the surveillance camera and somehow just make her as a human being, as an individual, into pixels on the monitor. Almost as something that can be easily erased and no one will know she ever existed. So that is what I think about the importance of film and cinema, is to give voice and give presence and give significance to those people. They might at the end, just like those pixels, can be easily erased. I want to tell their stories. I want to record their life in such a way that it will be remembered and also will somehow bring some significance of their existence while they're here.
Yet Jia Zhongke ends his film on an ambivalent note, which suggests that the traditions of the past may be a trap, while the brutality of the present at least limps forward. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.